Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the show Dana Levin. She is a poet. She's a teacher of poetry and creative writing. She'll be back at the, well, now it's called the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. You were formerly at the College of Santa Fe, yep. Which is the same thing in its new incarnation. And you will be reading tomorrow night, Thursday, at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 o'clock, reading poetry from your new book, which is called Sky Burial. And you will also be in conversation with poet John Davis. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So in your book, there are a lot of themes, death most notably among
yes.
them. Should we start with reading a poem?
Sure. Goodness. Okay, I'm going to read a prose poem called The Mentor. This is from a dream I had. One of the interesting things about the book is that I ended up writing a lot of poems from dream, and I also ended up writing a lot of poems from research. I guess they're sort of opposite ends of a spectrum. The Mentor. The mentor was in town to give a lecture. He was staying in my apartment. Too sick to attend, his wife stayed behind and I to nurse her. That night, the mentor still away, curled in pain, she crept to my room to sleep with me. Hunched in bed, she cried and shook, and in the morning, when I woke up, she was dead. I cradled her dead body in misery, for now I had to tell the mentor. I tracked him to a diner and found him in a booth drinking coffee. He was jovial, began showing me a collection of organa, eggs, seashells, stones, pond water in jars. I grab his hand mid-flourish, say, "Have you seen your wife?" And he looks confused, something gassing his eyes. He says, "Is she gone?" Getting upset, and then smiling, saying, "When she comes back, I don't think she'll come back as a person. I think she'll come back as her clothes. She loved them so, the threads, the dyes." Then he is staring into a tin can full of water, murky water, almost red, and I know this will be our science, mourning her.
Dana Levin. Now, I read that poem, and I thought, and this is, there's sort of a continuation between our conversation with Joan Logie a couple of days ago and you now. The thing that I've noticed so much is that poets seem to write about their own lives, and I was thinking, did this really happen? I'm really glad to hear it was a dream.
Yes. It really happened while I was asleep inside my mind.
Right.
But, you know, the book is, it was sparked by... My parents died in really quick succession in 2002, and then my mother's death after my father's was very shocking and sudden, and then my sister died 4 years later, and that was also very shocking and sudden. So I went from having an immediate family of five to having an immediate family of two, and I started to write, and I realized I had this rebellion against writing traditional laments, traditional elegies. I have a page in my journal that has no elegies in big black letters.
Why is that?
You know, it's only in retrospect do I've been thinking about it. I sometimes wonder if it was so painful and shocking to have that many deaths in so short of time. I just could not bear somehow attacking that directly. And also, I think what I really felt compelled to do, I wanted to make a confrontation with death. It wasn't that I wanted to memorialize my family or talk about how much I missed them, though I miss them a lot, even to this day. But I just was so, death was so thrown at me. I mean, we're all going to die, but we just spend our lives sort of trying to ignore that, or else how could we get up in the morning? But now it was sort of incontrovertible. I had to look at it. And so I started to study corpse decay. I started to study the insect symbiosis with cadavers. I started to research cross-cultural burial practices, different religious ideas about the relationship of the soul to the body. And I got very interested in the iconography of Tibetan Buddhism. And, of course, Buddhistic ideas of impermanence were actually very solacing for me. So there was all of this, you know, research conscious mind work going on, and then at the same time I was working from dreams too. And so I think because I wouldn't let myself write traditional elegy, I was thrown to the opposite poles, dream and research. And so sometimes I feel like the actual dead people, the parents and my sister, are kind of buried in a lot of these poems. Actually, that's a really weird thing to say.
Yeah.
Well, the book's called Sky Burial, so I guess that matters. But so that's sort of how the book was generated. And that dream, that poem, The Mentor, came from a dream I had 15 years ago. So there was a lot of kind of soul retrieval work, going back into past journals and finding material. It was an interesting process.
Some of the poems... And one knows from the subtitle or whatever, seem to be meditations on either religious icons or things that you've seen in museums, art, stuff like
right,
that.
Right.
What's that process like?
Well, I'm very sparked by imagery. Often my poems will begin by being fascinated by an image, and then the process of the poem is trying to understand why I'm so interested in the image. And there's just something about visual symbolism that just really reaches me. And I just really wanted to plumb those things that were exciting to me. So the Tibetan Buddhist iconography, like the wrathful deities, are these really scary-looking monsters. And... they're actually there to be sort of protective of you, but they're very intense. But I just love looking at them. And also the art, the way in which these tankas are made, reminded me of calendar art and tattoo art and illustration, and I love all that kind of stuff. And so I think my interest in Tibetan Buddhism started with those images. And then I really wanted to figure out how to write about them. That was very hard. And then I sort of realized that each time I tried to do this, to write about them, it was like my own way of meditating, I guess, because I just kept engaging the image and trying to allow poetry to happen, kind of a thing. So
there's in Buddhism the kind of underlying subtext that what the practice is all about is preparing for one's own death.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, and just to realize that nothing lasts. I mean, it sounds like such an ism. It sounds like such an easy thing to say, and yet it's really the only true thing about this plane of existence, that everything degrades, everything goes. And I actually found it very liberating to absorb that. Personally, I feel like it kind of calmed me down as a person and made me less... anxious about things, less control-oriented, because who has control? And more forgiving of people. Not that I'm a saint, absolutely not. But I like how it sort of calmed my mind down. So in that respect, all of these encounters with death, even though they were very painful, I feel very grateful for the experience, if I had to have it. Like, I don't feel bitter, I don't feel angry, I feel very, very grateful that I had such an intense class with death.
One of the kind of paradoxes of Buddhism is that when you give up control and when you accept impermanence and when you accept a kind of egolessness and on some level meaninglessness, then greater compassion and love and giving sort of flows in naturally.
Yes, I've definitely had that experience. And, you know, the primary thing was I had a difficult relationship with my mother, and she died so suddenly. There was no opportunity to work through that stuff. And I feel like I spent my whole life sort of holding her at bay. And then the minute she was dead, I could put my metaphorical arms down. And the minute I did that, I was so overcome by how much I had truly loved her, how much I missed her. And these feelings were so shocking to me, since my whole life had been about sort of keeping her at bay and trying to figure out how to separate and all this kind of stuff. And that was the first incursion of just kind of the heart cracking open through death and being more open to life. That's kind of the interesting paradox.
Is there a perhaps relevant poem that you would like to read?
Yes, I mean, there's a long one I won't read, but it's called White Tara, and that one really addresses directly what I've been talking about. But there's another poem called Ichor. Ichor was the immortal fluid that flowed in the veins of the Greek gods instead of blood that kept them deathless.
Yeah.
And this poem is a sort of a strange, surreal moment of realizing the parents in the blood. Ichor. The father died, and then the mother died. And you were so addicted to not feeling them, you told no one about the clamp inside, around the vena cava, dam against the blood's trash. But I've got you now. Trust at the waist, in a wooden chair, odor of spice and oranges, clove-pierced incandescent stores to light our lab's decor. Here, I saved this just for you. Beetle cleaned and sharp at the tip, the finger that shook in your set face from the hand that smoothed your hair. Make a fist. Wrap the tube round your fleshy arm. Pull the black rubber tight. Will we finally see the sludge of their accumulated mouths? Ah, you've said how they poisoned me. Pierce in with your mother's finger bone, taste the slow upwell. Sweet, sweet, surge ambrosial and clear, a honey, an ichor from those who waited long in your veins.
Dana Levin from her new book, Sky Burial. So you write in a number of different styles. You write prose poems and poems like the ones you just read, which are, what would you call it, blank verse?
Verse. Not even blank, but just free verse, I guess.
Free verse.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who are some of your influences, some of your... Joan Logie the other day called it soulmates.
Poetry soulmates.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting because as you go through life, some of those touchstones can change. William Carlos Williams from undergraduate days still stays with me. Eastern European poets, post-World War II, like Miroslav Halab and Vasco Popa, these are very interesting poets who worked in a surrealist vein, but they were very image-oriented. I really responded to that work. I studied for a time with the poet Charles Simic and also the poet Miroslav Halab from Czechoslovakia, so maybe that has something to do with my connection with those poets. But they also were great lovers of Williams, so it was kind of like, you know, loving Williams and then being introduced to a lineage. And then in graduate school, the two poets that mattered to me the most were Wallace Stevens and Jory Graham. And I think what those poets did was show me how to mix thinking with image. I mean, Williams says no ideas but in things, he's a little suspicious of too much conceptual thinking coming into the poems.
Which was much loved by contemporary artists of that time.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So then in graduate school, suddenly wanting to figure out how to get thinking in. And so Stevens and Jory Graham became very important. And then, you know, William Blake and Sylvia Plath have been important to me. And that probably, in terms of the poets that last. Oh, and a poet named Bert Myers that nobody knows about. Just a fantastic imagistic writer. He'll have, like, just these teeny little poems, something like bales of hay, cartons of sunlight fading in a field. Or two sailboats cross the bay as if the wind wore tennis shoes. And I just love these poems because there's like this nexus of visual metaphor where all of a sudden you see exactly what he sees. You can see how a bale of hay could be like a carton of faded sunlight. You can see how two sailboats would be like, you know, tennis shoes on the ocean. And weirdly, in taking the thing so far away, tennis shoes or cartons of sunlight, the thing itself, the sailboats and the bale of hay, is just renewed or refreshed, and suddenly I have to see it in this whole new way. And he mattered to me a lot in college, and he's a great teaching poet. Like with undergraduates, when I start to talk about metaphor and figuration, I always go back to Bert, and I wish more people knew about him. He died in 1978. He was not well known. Weirdly, University of New Mexico Press is the one that put out his collected poems a couple of years ago. It's called In a Dybbuk's Raincoat, and I just think he's great.
So you are going back to teaching this coming fall at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design.
Yes, yes.
And how does teaching work interact with your own poetry?
I think that it really it helps me think about the craft angle of poetry. I think in teaching poetry, I become a better editor of my own work. And I also just never get tired of seeing what students come up with. I just take great enjoyment from it. Great learning and great satisfaction comes from watching students figure out how to wrangle their own poems. In terms of teaching literature, I try to stay fresh in the field. I'm constantly reading younger poets and first book poets just to see what's going on out there. I definitely believe that art is one primary way that the culture speaks to itself, and poetry is an interesting vehicle for that. Since you know, certainly nobody reads poetry like they go to the movies or you know even YouTube. So in a way, poetry often presents a shadow history of the United States, or kind of talks about what's going on in the country that might not be promulgated by popular media and all that kind of stuff. So I'm always interested in what's happening with the zeitgeist, you know. Yeah. Sometimes I'm disapproving and sometimes I'm interested, but and I try to teach that way too, always putting the artistic product in historical context and talking to students about how is the spirit of the time coming through you or coming through the artists that you're reading. So
Dana Levin is a poet who will be reading tomorrow night, Thursday, at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 in the evening, and then we'll be in conversation with poet John Davis, whom we've had on the show a number of times.
Yes.
As well, another great friend and colleague of yours, so that should be great fun.
Yes, John is one of my oldest friends in Santa Fe, and when I was a young poet living in Burlington, Vermont, and could not get a single poem published, I sent some poems to a little magazine called Countermeasures that John was running with Greg Glazner, just out of the blue. I didn't know these guys, out of the College of Santa Fe. And John actually called me on the phone and said, "You're that poet we've been looking for."
Oh, how wonderful.
And I can't tell you what that meant, you know, after years of rejection.
Amazing.
And both he and Greg became great editors for my work and great early supporters. And it's the reason I ended up in Santa Fe. I ended up coming here to fill in for Greg when he went on sabbatical, and then I got a full-time job at College of Santa Fe, and I never left. And I think John is just a phenomenal poet. Everyone should read him. Read Preliminary Report.
Yes, read Preliminary Report and yes. His other works
yes,
as well.
Yes, Scrimmage of Appetite, Dangerous yeah. Amusements. He's a fantastic poet.
Dana Levin, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Blake Bradford. He is the director of the play Callback, which is produced by Zephyr Rep and Santa Fe Playhouse, and it's going into its last weekend this weekend. It's the last performances are Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And Jonathan Richards, who is one of the two stars of this show, welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
Hi.
So this is a genre which I don't always buy into, which is art about art. So this is theater about theater, but it's actually so well written and so interesting that it kind of gets away with being self-reflexive.
Right, right. I try to say, and Jonathan and I talked about this, because Santa Fe is such an artist town, that it's not just for actors, theater actors. It's for anyone who's really lived an artist's life. You know, the struggles. It follows these two characters, Joan Darling and Jonathan Richards, through 43 years of their lives of struggling, the highs and lows of being artists. Ed as a director, Judy as an actor. And it's the sort of struggle that any of us, dancers, painters, leading the sort of life that mom and dad never wanted you to lead, has always been something that all artists can share in common.
Right. And the thing about this kind of struggle is that it is not really quantifiable. You don't necessarily get to the top by being the best.
Right.
It can happen, and many of the people at the top are among the best, but it is easy to have plenty of talent and fall by the wayside because so much depends on where you are at what time, and if you get called for the right reading, and how you're feeling that day, and so many things go into it. So this story of these two people's lives in the theater, lives in an art form over half a century, will really speak to a lot of people.
It's so interesting because, I mean, we're all interested, I think, in what goes on behind the scenes to make something happen, whether it be a movie or, I mean, there's innumerable movies about artists, most of which are terrible, but what's so interesting to me about this one is precisely that question of success and failure. The character of Joan Darling is a character that, her name is Judy, who she's, if the script is accurate, I mean, she's immensely, immensely talented and never quite makes it. She does have some success as a director, but she never quite has her success as an actor. And, I mean, from the way you're talking, Jonathan, that is accurate?
Well, the thing, this, of course, the play was written by Joan Darling's husband, Bill Svano, and it's kind of a Valentine to Joan's career. Joan has had a very successful career in as an actress, as a director, and as a teacher, but she has not had, as the character in the play, never gets the really great Broadway role. It's not that she hasn't acted plenty and done some wonderful things, but she never quite got that particular brass ring, which is the brass ring that anybody coming to New York and wanting to be in theater is trying to grab.
Right. And we have so much talking about the success and what it does to these characters. Ed's character, Jonathan, he gets such success at an early age that it really sort of destroys his personal life. And so he spends a lot of the play trying to build back from that, and then he finds success again as a second time, which doesn't happen to a lot of us. But to piggyback on what Jonathan's saying about with Joan, she had two parts on Broadway, and both plays closed down about a week within opening. And it's that sort of thing that...
I think one closed on the second night,
right,
and one closed the night before it opened,
right,
so she has an average of opening night.
And Jonathan and I talk about this. All I ever wanted to do was have a play, to direct a play on Broadway, and ended up in TV, and I won an Emmy in 2008. And it has moved my career away from theater, which I love. And, you know, we talked about, Jonathan, talks a lot about, in our interviews, about how he started as an actor in New York, found a beautiful, beautiful woman in one of his acting classes, and how that changed his life. I'll let you...
Well, I did meet my wife back in around the time that this play starts, in the middle 60s. The play starts actually a few years earlier. I'm not... I'm not going to go back quite that far, but Claudia and I met in Herbert Berghoff's class in New York, and it was, you know, it was the same. The character that Joan plays, Judy, talks about when I first came to New York, all I wanted to do was classical theater. I wouldn't even dream of doing commercial theater, and the idea of doing a commercial was a Class A felony. That's the way, I don't know how actors talk today, but back in the 60s when Claudia and I were going to Herbert Berghoff's class, actors would sit around in Gray's coffee shop and they would talk endlessly about the only things they would really accept. You know, I had a friend who would only consider doing Polish theater. He didn't want to do anything. And the idea of doing a commercial really was considered, you just would not even consider that. Then what happened was that Sir Laurence Olivier did a television commercial for, I think it was Polaroid, but it was or Kodak, but it, and then the conversation shifted a little bit. Young actors would say, "Well, if it was something classy like what Olivia did, maybe I would consider doing it." Yeah, right.
If it was an art medium like photography,
exactly. Right. Yeah, if it's something really classy, you would never do Dreft or something like
no,
that.
No, 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 no. It's got to be classy like Polaroid, right?
Very interesting. We're talking about the play Callback at the Santa Fe Playhouse that is running through this weekend, Thursday through Sunday. I think another interesting thing about this play, I mean, these two characters, they first meet in 1962, and so you have Joan Darling and Jonathan Richards playing 20-somethings.
Well, it's a bit of a stretch.
Well, so much.
It reminded me of that, of Same Time Next Year,
right?
Which is both a play and a movie that stretches over decades. And in the movie, there's no close-ups in the first...
Of course. Or the Dynasty thing, where it's kind of like the Vaseline over the lens.
The Joan Collins shot.
But anyway, one of the things that's also really interesting about it is that, in a way, you're set up for having this be a budding, burgeoning love story. But in fact, it turns out to really be, as it goes on, a friendship story.
Right.
And that's also something that's unusual and kind of beautiful.
Well, I think that's one of the great things about the play, is it doesn't fall into the cliche. And, you know, you talked earlier, there's so many... it's not so fun to watch a lot of art about art. And Robert Altman, of course, made a great career out of making those sort of movies. And there's the musical The Last 5 Years, A.R. Gurney's Love Letters. And what's fun about this play is, as long as the two actors are similar aged... any age can do this play, because it does go through 43 years from 1962 to 2005.
Now, you did a student production of it at North Carolina, didn't you?
Actually, when we did it off-Broadway in New York, I had Joan Darling and a 70s TV actor that I won't name. I also ran it with a 30-something-year-old cast. So I had two casts of the show. And, you know, one night we would have the 30-somethings playing it, and one night we would have Joan and the other actor. And it's so interesting to see the slight differences that happen, because, you know, of course, younger actors don't know what the 1960s were like.
Right.
So they sometimes have to do a little bit more research.
We remember being young better than they remember.
They remember
being
old. Yeah.
Well, one of the nice things in this production is that you have, as the scenes change, you have all these visuals and also music representing the iconic images and, to some extent, music of the time period.
Well,
so
Blake,
from the
Blake
60s.
Blake put that together, that slideshow, and it serves several purposes. For one thing, it takes you back and reminds you with the images and the music of what was going on in those particular years. And it also serves to entertain the audience while the scenes are being changed.
While you change your costumes.
While we change our costumes. As we're back there frantically tugging ties over our heads.
13 costume changes that Jonathan and Joan have to deal with.
Right.
And we've had such fun, because I, of course, wanted to keep those transitions as short as possible. And Jonathan and Joan, they didn't enjoy that as much as I did. you know, we've had all sorts of, you'll have to tell your tie story.
Well, the first night, I guess it was opening night, I had to, or possibly the final preview, but an audience was out there, and... I had to pull a tie over my head, and the tie jammed, and it wouldn't loosen, so I had to just force it up over my head, and I had a little scab on my ear. And I got out on the stage for the next scene, and I suddenly felt something sort of wet on my neck, and I reached
blood
up.
Blood running down your...
Blood was pouring down my neck. It wasn't just like a little spot or two. It was like Lady Macbeth. Fortunately, it was my upstage ear. I got to play most of the scene upstage, but Blake could tell from up in the booth. And I was I just had to, you know.
You think is this part of the drama?
Yeah.
Well, it we
the bloody hand. But
anyway.
he was genius. He just changed the blocking. He still kept all of the movement going, but he was slightly turned upstage with that right ear for the whole scene.
Amazing.
And due to the wonderful technology we have in theaters, the backstage stage manager, I was texting her to have her ready with some medical supplies.
A tourniquet,
something to stop the blood flow.
So, just so the audience knows, this is not for sissies, this theater
business.
Yes, this theater business. Well, and I mean, another thing that's beautiful about this play is it's a kind of love letter, not only to Joan Darling, but to theater itself.
Yes,
and what theater can do. And really the poignancy that... whether you're in the arts or not, whatever your life is, that there are just those few moments in a lifetime where something profound and beautiful happens that you participate in and that you make happen.
And these characters, they sometimes go 6 years without seeing each other. And they've just built such a bond over, in one of the earliest scenes, they talk about how much they love theater. And that sets this lifelong bond that they can go 6 years and pick up right where they left off.
Right, but picking up on what Mary Charlotte was saying, there is a line in the play where Judy refers to, she says, a play is something that only happens once. That's the great thing about live theater is that your experience that night in seeing the show, in playing the show, is only going to happen that night. It'll be a little different tomorrow night. It was a little different the night before. And actors will come off stage and say, wow, we really got it tonight. Or they come off stage and say, I don't know, it just isn't, you know. But by the time you've done a show a number of times, the tolerance, the range of on the downside, I think, is pretty well controlled. But there are still moments, and again, Joan has a line about this, where she says there was one night when I was playing Dorothy Parker in a little place in New Jersey, and I just nailed it, and the connection with the audience was just there. And those, of course, are wonderful moments.
Right.
And they're
and
we
have
so
them every
few.
Night.
Yes.
This is not a show in which we normally gossip, but I would have to... there's a character in it. There's a lot of characters who never come on stage, but they're named. For example, Jonathan's character has a long-standing relationship on and off with somebody named Faye Dunkirk. Now, that's pretty thinly veiled Faye Dunaway.
Really?
Yes.
You know, that never occurred to us.
Never occurred. No. Well, look, I don't live in Santa Fe, so I'll spill all the beans and then run out of town. Yes, it is based off of Faye Dunaway, that character. And one of the fun things about this play is it is extremely... There are some hilarious parts in Act 1, not just for people that are in the art community, but just the craziness that you go through in this industry. And we meet the Faye Dunkirk character as she is also in an improv troupe the same time as our lead female. And she's described as a not-so-kind character who is constantly on the phone yelling at her managers and agents to get the top directors, or she will kill them, their mistresses, their children and their dogs. So she's not painted very positively in the beginning.
But she becomes a more sympathetic character as the time goes on. And again, this is always just by reference. We never actually see her on stage. But I think there's also a kind of a grudging admission, even in the beginning, that sometimes that's what it takes to succeed in an art form that is as competitive as theater is.
Right.
And then back to Joan Darling's character, Judy, doesn't really have that sort of brutal competitiveness.
No.
She just has raw and honed talent, and then ends up kind of doing other things with her life, but always coming back to theater.
Right, and always, and the other thing she does, she has great success, but there's just that little slightly sour edge to the, you know, to the drink, which is that the one thing she wanted, the great starring role on Broadway, never materializes.
And since you brought it up, I would like to say it's really fun because, yes, the play was written for Joan Darling. But now, having worked on a couple of productions and finally getting Jonathan in this role, it's such a challenge that I'm sure you could speak to. But, you know, Joan has a lot of biography that she talks about in the play, whereas Jonathan's character, he had to come up with from scratch just based off the script,
right,
which can sometimes be more complicated, but also can be easier as an actor to be able to distance yourself from some of the things that you do.
Well, I'm not sure if distancing is really it, but there's a lot in the script that indicates who the character is at every given moment, and so for me, it's not such an arduous challenge to find who the character is, because you play it and you have a good director like Blake who points you in the right direction.
Now, Blake, you are clearly a wonderful director, but you're just passing through town.
That's right.
That's not fair.
That's right. I've been to Santa Fe one time before, and that was to go to Taos for a wedding. But now I've been here for 6 weeks doing this show and have fallen in love with the town. But I normally live in New York and L.A., more now in L.A. doing TV work.
Blake's association goes back a number of years with Joan Darling and Bill Svano. And Joan and Bill, as you know, used to live here for many years before they moved to North Carolina to teach. And so they wanted to come back here and do this show in the town where they had a lot of association, a lot of memories, and a lot of friends. And they wanted, so that they were responsible for bringing Blake here to do the show that he had staged before, but to stage it especially for a Santa Fe audience.
Right, and you and Joan had been looking for plays. They'd been looking for plays for the two of them to do together, very much like the characters in the show had always been looking to work together, and this was just the synchronicity of it finally working out.
Well, we hope to have you back in Santa Fe. The play is called Callback. Blake Bradford is the director, Jonathan Richards and Joan Darling are the two actors, and it runs Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 8 in the evening, Sunday at 2 o'clock. That's the last performance. And if people want to get tickets, they can call 988-4262 or go to santafeplayhouse.org. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary.
Thank you.
I'm happy now to welcome to the program Hank Rogerson, Melissa Nelson, and Kara McCoy. They are with Bioneers. They've just made a film of which Hank is the director, Melissa is the executive producer, and Kara, she's the actual Bioneers person. She's the manager of the Indigenous program there. The film is called Circle of Stories, and it is screening here in Santa Fe at The Screen on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design on Thursday, the 21st of April at 7 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So how did this film develop? How did it come to be?
Well, originally, actually, it started back in 2002, and Jillian Spitzmiller, who's my filmmaking partner, and I were approached by PBS to propose a project that would be documentary storytelling for the web. So it would go on pbs.org. And we proposed a documentary about Native storytelling and its historical relevance and contemporary relevance as well. And we were one of the chosen projects. So that was in the beginning of 2002. And a part of the proposal was that we wanted to team up with a Native organization. And I just happened to be reading a magazine called Orion, and there was an article in there that was written by Melissa, along with Phil Klasky and their organization, Cultural Conservancy. And I just thought it was a fantastic article. It looked like they were a great organization, and we wrote them a letter, and we got back a very enthusiastic yes. And they came on board, and took about 6 months to make the website itself. And in collaboration with Cultural Conservancy and a web design company out of Portland called Second Story. The site actually premiered at the Sundance Film Festival and showed at South by Southwest and a couple other festivals and then went live on pbs.org. And it's still there. It's pbs.org/circle of stories. Ever since we made the project, Jillian and I were always like, well, we have all this footage in the vault because basically the website is done in Flash and screen grabs and photographs. But we have all this documentary footage of the four storytellers because the site is built around four storytellers from the four directions. And we were always like, well, we should do something with this footage. And finally, in about 2008... I started looking at the footage and putting together an educational documentary, which is what we're going to be showing at The Screen. There's a couple versions of the film. We're going to be showing the 35-minute version. And, you know, basically on weekends and weeknights and over the summer, I started compiling and putting together the documentary, which is what we have now, the educational documentary called Circle of Stories. And it centers, again, around the four storytellers from the four directions. Rosella Goodwill Archdale from the north, and she's Lakota Dakota. From the east, we have Chin, and he's Narragansett. And from the south, we have Hosky Benali Jr., who's Diné, and he's actually from Shiprock, and he'll be coming to the screening on the 21st. And then to the west, we have Corbin Harney, who's Western Shoshone.
Okay. Now, when you are doing a project like this, First of all, the footage that you have in the film, is that also available on the web, or is it only, do you have to actually get the DVD or see a screening of it?
Well, basically what's on the web is it's done in screen grabs and photographs and put into Flash, so it's more of a, it's not the moving image,
okay.
If you know what I mean.
Right.
There is some streaming video on the site itself, but basically what we have in the film is the live storytellers integrated with transitional footage, landscape footage, photographs, in order to help bring the stories more alive. And then it's narrated by Melissa in order to weave the stories together, because the storytellers come from the four directions and they're all different traditionally. We actually film them in different ways, in a cinema verite style, which is as the, a woman's cooking and she's telling us a story as she's cooking, and Corbin Harney gives a ceremony and we film the ceremony. Hosky Benally is sitting down and telling us a story, so it's more from a talking head type style. And Chin is in performance. He's actually someone who uses magic and tricks and props to help.
It's
tell.
Like a children's show.
Yeah, but I mean, with adult themes as well. And so stylistically, we shot it in all different ways, and that's why we brought in Melissa to help us sort of weave it all together and tell us more about the storytellers themselves and their traditions.
Melissa, tell us about the Cultural Conservancy.
Yes, the Cultural Conservancy is happy to have just celebrated our 26th year. We're a Native American Indigenous Rights nonprofit organization based in San Francisco, California. We've worked in Indian country for over 25 years, mainly in the West, California, the Southwest, North America. We've also worked with Pacific Islander communities and in South America. Our mission is to preserve and revitalize indigenous cultures and their ancestral lands. So we've always had this integrated focus of cultural preservation, revitalization, and environmental protection. We've done a lot of work around sacred sites, the preservation of sacred sites, indigenous languages, plants, ethnobotany, access to traditional lands. And so we are very delighted to get the call from Hank and Jillian to collaborate on this PBS website about Circle of Stories. One of our projects, the Storyscape Project, specifically looks at basically recording, documenting, and revitalizing the storytelling tradition, oral literature, songs, song cycles. In fact, that's how we got to know Kara McCoy, is through our Salt Song Trail project, which is very exciting. So we've been actively recording storytellers, singers for a long time, and we were happy to work with Philomath Films to create first the website and then to develop this educational documentary that's really visually rich and amazingly profound in terms of the teachings from the different storytellers.
Kara, you are with the Bioneers Indigeneity Program. What's that all about?
I'm the program manager there for the Indigeneity Program, and the way that this all came about is kind of in the intimate social scene of Santa Fe. Melissa's here in town and had the opportunity to meet Hank, and we started brainstorming a bit, but since the inception of Bioneers, Indigenous thinking has been deeply rooted in the mold of Bioneers as a critical path to restoring social and ecological justice to our lives and our communities. And the word indigeneity speaks to the elemental connection between people and place. And because disconnection from place and cultural erosion are among the leading causes of severe social and ecological problems, it's a critical time for people to reconnect. So we have a formalization of the Indigeneity Program. We're creating a local awareness and alliance building and a bridge between cultures, and we thought that the screening of the Circle of Stories would be a great opportunity, an invitational format for people to participate in that cultural exchange.
The Cultural Conservancy has been involved with the Bioneers organization as a partner since 1993, and I've always been impressed that Bioneers has always made a really important space in their Bioneers conference and in their program for Indigenous speakers to talk about various issues from health and environment and language. And so we're really happy to formally develop this Indigeneity program with Kara McCoy as the director, coming on as a Chimoevi woman. I'm very involved with the Santa Fe local community and also with media. So it was a perfect link to bring her on and also to work with Philomath Films in this collaborative way for this local event. So we're really excited about that.
In the film Circle of Stories, you talk about how in order to move us toward a world in which we live more sustainably in relation to the earth, it's important to have these stories. And I was watching the stories, I was like, how does a myth about how the rabbit got long ears help us live closer to the earth?
Great question. And basically for a lot of Native peoples, these stories about like something that seems very insignificant perhaps about long-eared rabbits and how they got that way, speak to our kinship and our relationship with the rabbit, that it's just not an external creature to us, that we're actually related to the rabbit, that we help form the rabbit as the rabbit helped to form us. So it goes back really to what we call original instructions, to archetypes, to natural law, that tells us the ethics of how to relate to nature. So it's much more of an ethical framework than it is how to cook a rabbit, how to eat a rabbit, that's also involved. So today we are really, really struggling with having a sustainable relationship with animals and with plants and with everything in the environment, non-human. And these stories remind us that if the rabbit is going extinct, then we are going extinct. We are intimately entwined in the survival of both species.
Although, I mean, I was watching it going, that's not how the rabbit got long ears. It's a story. It's like a Rudyard Kipling story. It's like any kind of kid's story that's pure fantasy, but it's not grounded in, you know, any kind of evolutionary adaptivity, you know, how things actually and why they are the way they are.
I would just question your assumption that Western science is also a story. Evolution is also a story, and we certainly have evidence through archaeology and other means, but it's really just another form of a story. And for Native peoples, these stories are just as real as Darwin's evolutionary story. And we find many, many gaps in the evolutionary story. We've just taken it to become truth because of the authority of Western knowledge and science. But for Indigenous peoples, we have as much evidence that we are related to the rabbit, we are related to how he got long ears, and these stories are just as real.
We're related to them through evolutionary theory as well.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, Western science, thank goodness, is finally coming around to understanding a lot of the things that traditional ecological knowledge has been saying in terms of symbiosis, coevolution. There's many, many theories, even quantum entanglement from physics is really supporting ideas that creation stories talk about from Native peoples.
We're talking about the film Circle of Stories, which is showing at the screen on Thursday, the 21st of April at 7 o'clock. Now, there's a panel discussion after the film. Is that correct, Kara?
There is, and we're actually really excited about that portion of the event. We had about 9 people step forward, incredibly excited, both Indigenous leaders and allies, Kenny Ozabel, Nina Simons, Melissa K. Nelson, Hosky Benally. The filmmakers will be there, as well as Lois Ellen Frank, to engage in that participative space for people to explore Indigeneity, as well as touch on the critical topic at the heart of the Indigeneity program, which is traditional ecological knowledge, and how that is going to be the restorative approach to life-saving ways of living.
Bioneers, of course, is a wonderful organization that does all kinds of unusual restoration projects and things like that.
Exactly. Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature, has a bunch of incredible programs. One is a local one, Dreaming New Mexico, that's really looking at how to restore the lands, the waters, and energy self-sufficiency for the state of New Mexico. So it's a very exciting local project that is getting a lot of national attention as a model for remapping our food sheds, our watersheds, and our energy grid. and working again towards more sustainable systems. So Bioneers has a strong localization focus as well as a globalization focus and networking with other organizations doing similar restoration work. And then the new Indigeneity program, of course, is finally really officially solidifying Bioneers' commitment to indigenous peoples, to human rights, to environmental struggles, and to basically creating long-term sustainable partnerships to some of our world's most pressing environmental problems.
And Bioneers can be found on the web at bioneers.org, and you can get tickets there as well. Hank Rogerson is director of the film Circle of Stories. Melissa Nelson is executive producer, and Kara McCoy is manager of the Indigenous programs at Bioneers. And we will see you on Thursday, the 21st of April at 7 o'clock at the screen.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.